Coming to you from the ancestral territory of the Anishinaabe and the area inhabited by the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation, this is Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us, seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking. We hope to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. I am speaking with Helena Norberg Hodge, founder and director of Local Futures. Helena is the author, filmmaker, and founder of Local Futures, and she is a pioneer of the new economy movement and been promoting economics of a personal, social, and ecological well-being for more than 30 years. Welcome to Earth Matters, Helena.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
So let's start perhaps at the beginning. In 1975, you went to Ladakh, a small village near the Himalayas, and tell us what you saw there at that time, what brought you there, and you've been back many times since, so what changes have you seen?
Yes, well, it's actually a rather large region. It's about the size of Austria and with about 100 villages. So it's a big region, but with quite a small population, and it's the westernmost part of Tibet. So it's really more Tibetan, really, even than Tibet now, because this part of Tibet has belonged to India for a long time. And because the borders were disputed, and when the Chinese were coming into central Tibet, the Indians had an army up on the borders to China and also to Pakistan, and it was considered very sensitive, and so no one was allowed to go there. And then for political reasons, in order to place this part of Tibet on the Indian map to the world, they opened it up to tourism in the mid-70s. And I was a linguist living in Paris. I'm Swedish, English, German. I'd had a lot of international experience and spoke a lot of languages. And I was asked to help make this documentary about this ancient culture. And I was going to be there for only 6 weeks to help make the film, but I just fell in love with these remarkable, joyous, vital people and this beautiful part of the world, and ended up staying when the film was finished. And yeah, I've sort of stayed ever since, in a way, in that my organization has continued to work there.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a bit about Local Futures, the organization you started. Why did you start that?
I started it really, well, way back then. I started doing things probably in 76, you know, writing to the Indian government and basically suggesting that a development model based on fossil fuels and transporting things into Ladakh over the high Himalayas didn't make sense, and I was sort of recommending a more Gandhian development model, one that would be based on renewable energy and greater self-reliance. And so I started doing projects, and at first my organization was called the Ladakh Project, but then after a few years we were invited to work in Bhutan, and there was interest from many other places because we ended up having one of the largest sort of appropriate technology projects in the world, apparently. And our work was also unusual in that I had learned to speak the language fluently and had realized that in the early years, the Ladakhis didn't have any sense of inferiority. They never referred to themselves as poorer or backward or stupid. But I saw that with the advent of what we call development, with Western schooling, with Western media, with the tourists, suddenly young Ladakhis started thinking of themselves as being stupid and backward. And so my work, speaking the language fluently, was very much about actually demystifying a romanticized version of our consumer culture, which looks on the other side of the world as though our life is, you know, just a paradise. It looks as though we don't work. And all these other people who are still fishing or farming or working outside, they are made to feel, you know, really stupid and backward. And they get the impression that we have just as much leisure as they do. just as much free time as they do, and we don't have to do any physical work. So a lot of the work that we started doing, and I say we, later on I met my husband, who was a lawyer, a barrister, and he had been in South America and become very interested in traditional culture, and so he came out to Ladakh. I had been there working for 3 years, and then he joined, and I also had help from an organization started by E.F. Schumacher, who wrote the book Small is Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And that book had really influenced me because I actually read it in my first year in Ladakh, and he was an economist and a man, a very important economist, very mainstream, and he had almost identical experience in Burma, where he had also found that people who had not been colonized and who were still living according to their own skills and with ways that they had developed over many centuries, managing their own resources, you know, there was no real poverty. I mean, poverty, as we know it, is really a creation of an economic system that in a very short time in Ladakh, and later on I witnessed it also in Bhutan and other places, creates unemployment. You know, unemployment never existed traditionally. There was just no such thing. So there's this artificial creation of scarcity of livelihoods, and through this channel of energy-intensive technologies and top-down, either big business or large bureaucracies. So questioning all that and trying to promote an understanding about the need for more localized economic development, a way of strengthening local economies worldwide, that's something that we started doing very early on. And later on, the organization was, we named it Local Futures, but we're also known as the Economics of Happiness, because that's really what localization offers, is by strengthening people's self-esteem and their ability to have secure livelihoods and to be more interdependent with human scale institutions, so that, you know, they're not dependent on giant unknown corporations or government bureaucracies where there's not even a name, no face, you don't really know what these forces are, we don't know who owns our water, we have no idea who produces our food, it all goes via these enormous institutions and over great distances. So when you start shortening the distances and people start becoming more dependent, as I say, on each other and on human scale institutions, there's an amazing shift that happens, and we're very proud and very happy to have been pioneers of promoting that around the world.
So it sounds like you went to Ladakh at a very critical time when the communities were self-sufficient. As you say, there was no unemployment. People felt good about their situation. What's the situation today? How is Ladakh?
Well, today we have, I would say, a situation that's very similar to most parts of the world, and that is that the dominant trends supported by government are dramatically in the wrong direction. They are still based on fossil fuels, creating incredible pollution. I mean, this is at a high altitude. We're talking about 12,000 feet, and so every engine has to work harder. The air is thinner, and so the air that, when I arrived, was almost certainly the clearest, purest air on this planet is probably now, almost more polluted than anywhere else. And then mountains of plastic waste, and all of this because of this blind adherence to, which unfortunately every government I know of still believes in, which is that supporting global trade and increased global trade benefits our societies. And what they're really doing is supporting enormous multinational banks and corporations, thinking that, oh, you know, if we support, you know, in America we're supporting General Motors and that helps America, or in Sweden we're supporting Volvo and that's going to help Sweden. That's just not what's happening. You know, what's happening is that we're getting this global elite, and we're getting, as most people know now, about eight men owning more than half of the global population, and we're getting these enormous, far too large corporations that become just like giant bureaucracies, but they also pressure our governments that then, in a very bureaucratic way, are imposing very counterproductive regulations on us. Every individual, every business that operates within the national arena is pressured by heavy regulations and heavy taxes. Now, in the meanwhile, those that are multinationals swan around free and easy through so-called free trade treaties, and generally they don't pay tax. I am just so hoping we can get this message out, because I don't think even the most, you know, ardent neoliberal thinker is not in support of monopolies. You know, this is not part even of the most sort of right-wing conservative thinking. But that's basically what we have when we allow these global businesses not to pay tax and to have no rules. In fact, it's more than that. They're actually setting the rules now. They're actually forcing governments to sign in black and white that you will not do anything. I mean, governments are signing. We won't do anything that could reduce your profit-making potential. So come and invest in us. And the whole business of being invested from abroad, you know, it does not benefit most societies. It doesn't benefit most towns. So I'm really, you know, like I say, very happy and so amazed by the number of local economy initiatives that are emerging. And it's particularly around local food, but even business alliances. And another very clear pattern is that local governments, and sometimes even regional governments, are tending to respond more to the needs of their constituency and the needs of their environment. So there is this very clear sign that people want something else and that we can do it differently, but we need to get the word out so that more people can start doing these things and benefit from them.
Now, your journey was somewhat documented by a film that you produced called The Economics of Happiness. And tell us how people can connect with that film. Can they see it? Can they download it?
Yes, absolutely. If they come to our website, which is localfutures.org, they can download this film, and it is now in at least 26 languages. And we also have another film called Ancient Futures, which has been very valuable as an educational tool. It focuses just on Ladakh and on this dramatic transition that happened there, where it's so clear. It was very black and white, because there had been no unemployment. There had also not been suicide. I mean, when I say that, I mean maybe one in a generation, that sort of thing. And therefore also, you know, depression was unknown. I used to explain to people that, yes, on the screen and in the adverts, it looks like these Westerners are so amazingly happy, and it looks like they do no work. But actually, we're working far, far harder than you are. And we even have such unhappiness that people go to special doctors that are to do with mental problems, mental illness, not physical. And people just, you know, they couldn't even comprehend what I was talking about. But then I saw how, with the advent of this new system, which also included Western-style schooling, the whole worldview was so destructive of a more collaborative way of being and also of self-respect, sort of being loved and seen for who you are and appreciated for who you are, and not being subjected to screens that make it seem as though somewhere else people are much happier and much better off. So you know, our film Ancient Futures, our film The Economics of Happiness, and our books, I have a book named Ancient Futures also, which describes this situation in Ladakh where it was so black and white. And I'm sorry to tell you now that you asked about what Ladakh is like now, and now the suicide rate among young people is as high as sort of the average in many Western countries, where people need to know that suicide among young people is dramatically on the increase. And it's entirely when you analyze it from a broad point of view and with experience in both industrialized and non-industrialized countries, it's so clear that it's to do with the pressures from this globalized economy that is pushing children to study more material and be more insecure. Parents are even insecure before their children are born now about, are they going to get into a good school, and how are we going to find, you know, a decent education, and with the hope of getting, you know, a really good job. And these good jobs are almost without any exception concentrated in mega cities where the house prices are completely out of reach. So young people are put in this, you know, terrible, stressful situation worldwide, and it's, you know, one of the reactions is depression, anxiety, suicide, drug addiction, and the other one is violence. So I know this sounds a bit negative, but I'm really wanting people to face that bigger picture and realize that to change things in a direction that would dramatically reduce not just job insecurity and gap between rich and poor, but anxiety, depression, and even suicide, as well as reducing emissions and other forms of pollution that are entirely a consequence of large-scale industrial production, mm-hmm. whether in farming, fishery, forestry. So we have an opportunity by supporting a new economy movement and a shift away from globalizing and subsidizing global business towards, we need to actually shift the subsidies to start with to support smaller. So there is a broad picture there, and there is a absolutely, you know, rapidly growing localization movement that offers so much hope and inspiration. So do come to our website, localfutures.org, and we have on the website also a series we call Planet Local, where we highlight some of the many projects and initiatives around the world that people can learn from.
Mm-hmm. And the most recent thing that you've done, you've just released a book that you've written called Local is Our Future, Steps to Economics of Happiness. So tell me a little bit about what that book features and how people can find out how to get that book. Because it's a bit more positive than what you've just been saying. So.
Well, it is. I mean, the entire book is showing both sides. It's showing that there are two paths into the future. And on the one hand, unfortunately, almost every national government is embracing a continued mega industrial, mega urbanizing, mega corporate direction through global trade treaties. On the other hand, people around the world are voting with their feet, are voting with their hearts, are voting for the absolute need to reconnect to others and to the natural world. And that fundamental path of reconnection is really being in touch with who we are, how we evolved. And this is what, you know, what I got to see in Ladakh was that when people have real community, and traditionally it was also intergenerational community, so that every mother had, you know, roughly 10 live-in caretakers for every child, you know, you get a very different picture. But what I'm most happy about, and what I hope the book will offer people, is the recognition that, yes, we need to learn from ancient indigenous cultures, and we have to go way back in many societies to see what it was like when people were really free, what it was like before we had, you know, what is called a patriarchal system, because, you know, we had a period when, you know, over about 500 years, when about 10 million women were burned as witches. And these were from cultures where we were more nature-based and where the role of women and the feminine had a higher status. So it wasn't just about women versus men. It was a culture that allowed the feminine principle, a sense of connection, collaboration, interdependence, because that's basically how things worked when we weren't being overrun by, you know, so-called civilizations that would conquer and destroy other cultures. So we can learn a lot from the past, and that's partly what Ancient Futures offers. But I'm hoping that people will be most, well, at least as inspired by seeing that there's a pattern out there. I call it sort of ancient futures micro trends, where people are simply moving in that direction. And very often it is people who can afford to do it. You know, it's often sort of middle class people who will say, well, I'm not going to keep rushing into that big city for that 80-hour a week job and be, you know, concerned about having the consumer gadgets to try to get the love I'm looking for. People have had enough self-reflection. They've worked, you know, sort of on some inner consciousness raising, and they realize what really makes them happy is to feel more connected to other people. And by the way, there's so much evidence of that. There's so much, you know, that shows that people who suffer from depression, when they are in community and when they have contact with nature, that the depression decreases. And I can show you, you know, prison projects where prisoners who, you know, their whole lives have been angry, or projects with juvenile delinquents who have just been helped to be out in nature and to form a deeper conversation and sense of connection with other people. And usually to sort of help this happen, it requires wisdom. It requires, you know, sometimes elders to help this process to happen. Mm-hmm. But it is so inspiring to see that in a multitude of ways, in the modern world, even inside the big cities, this process of reconnecting to others and to nature is happening. And how it's basically the economics of happiness, because you can actually improve your life or the life of others in such a short period by being more conscious of this basic principle and this other path that really is a sort of coming home to a sense of connectedness to other people and to nature. Now, the sense of connectedness is so dramatically reinforced also when it even has an economic component. So, for instance, you know, we see in farmers' markets, farmers who had been basically, you know, educated to believe that they need to use more and more chemicals and they need to keep pushing to produce, you know, this one standardized product that's going to be, you know, washed by machines and then on the supermarket shelves, needs to be all the same size and no blemishes on it. So when we start farmers' markets, suddenly you have this amazing transformation. And, you know, farmers have said to me, one in Australia, you know, he said, you know, after you started the farmers' market, it was like entering another galaxy. You know, my whole life I've been a farmer and I felt like a serf. I was, you know, the market from the big city pressuring in the way I just said, you know, towards standard products and often having to waste, you know, so much food in that system. And now in the farmers' market, you actually have quite conservative farmers coming together with more green, left-leaning consumers who appreciate what they grow, who are actually often relieved to see a few blemishes because they know that shows that they haven't used all kinds of toxic sprays. And so the wonderful thing about localizing, especially in food production, is that it creates markets that stimulate and encourage diversity on the land. And I've seen this happening, you know, even in China and in Japan, Korea. We've ended up in my organization very, very globalized, and we completely believe in global information exchange, collaboration. That's another paradoxical thing about understanding localization from a global perspective. And I do think when people see it from the global perspective, they'll feel more empowered and more motivated. So I hope overall that my book, you know, is positive. Mm-hmm. But we do need to understand also that other path that's being pushed on us in order to build a stronger movement for real systemic change.
And you are seeing other organizations, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and the Business Alliance for Local Living Economics, saying similar messages. Are you seeing a growing turn towards local activities? Because as you state in your book, it connects you with nature, it connects you with your neighbors, it's a more resilient community. able to withstand, whether it's climate change or economic varieties. So what are you seeing the change to being local? Do you see it growing? Do you see it leaps and bounds?
Definitely growing, and it's definitely growing by leaps and bounds. Mm-hmm. So it's a very sharp curve upwards, but it's still far too small, and I think that one of the actions, one of the activisms that's getting skipped over is the need to spread the word, and so I call that big picture activism. Mm-hmm. And remember, and also I really believe that if we have clarity about the path that is being, that's moving us towards larger and larger scale, faster and faster, pushing virtually every individual and business to use more energy and technology, a path that right now is romanticizing robots, telling us that robots are going to be wiser and kinder than people, that path is disastrously in the wrong direction. It's dumping the most abundant renewable resource we have, overabundant resource, humans, and human labor, human intelligence, dumping that in favor of using energy and scarce mineral and other scarce resources and creating this inhuman life, you know. And we know we don't want to phone up a government agency or a business and sit on the phone for ages pushing buttons and talking to robots. And, you know, we know we don't like it when we go, you know, to the airport and there's just machines there to deal with. And you know, just, you know, ridiculous things, trains where you can't open the windows and now you can't even open the doors without using electronics. And all of that electronic imposition is favoring unemployment and climate change. You know, it's really disastrous. And then on the other side, you know, in the direction towards local business alliances and so on, what's also happening is that people are beginning to relearn all kinds of skills, like, you know, even making a simple wooden bowl or a wooden spoon. It's bringing so much joy to people who never in their entire education ever learned how to be productive in that way and how to use their hands. And by the way, there's now also very interesting research which shows that this is incredibly important for the brain. The hand-eye coordination is what makes us sharper and brighter. So, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, people, you know, love learning to contribute, actually as a community project, to build a house out of natural materials these days. It's happening, you know, particularly in movements like the permaculture movement. I'm part of a network called an Ecoversity Network. So there are a lot of institutions, you know, that are springing up around the world.
Well, I was going to say you and your organization are very busy. You've got webinars, you've got publications. Again, your most recent book, Local is Our Future, is available. And in September, you are attending the Economics of Happiness Conference in Ladakh. And in Japan, you'll be at the International Forum on Happiness in November. People can find out more by going and looking at the film Economics of Happiness. And as your Twitter feed says, you are working toward policies and practices that place the well-being of local communities above corporate profits.
Yeah.
That's unfortunately all the time we have, so I encourage people to go to localfutures.org to find out more. And
I also just say localfutures.org, and that we are organizing conferences around the world, and we'd be very keen to do one in Canada, and we've done quite a few in the United States, and the forum in Japan is part of our work too. So I hope, people do go to the website, and that we can hear from people from Canada, perhaps organizing something on the ground.
All right. I've been speaking with Helena Norberg Hodge, founder of Local Futures. Thank you very much for joining us on Earth Matters. Lawson Hunter here, host and producer of Earth Matters. I wanted to thank all the listeners of Earth Matters for your continuing support. As always, please feel free to send us your comments, suggestions, and thoughts on topics and people we should look at for future programs. Email us at earthmatters@newsandcomment.com. News, A-N-D, comment.com.